We will call the Senate Committee, Joint Committee on Tax Credits to order. Welcome, everyone. As you recall, we didn't quite make it through the film credit hearing last time, so we will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2167. And we'll start out with Justin Habel. Oh, they did. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, Elaine Guiney and Bill Perry and Angie Delks. I'm sorry, Alana. I was having trouble with the handwriting here.
We've been joking, she's our chaperone this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Angie Delks with the Oregon Business Association. For the record, the first time the guy that I sometimes claim is my husband and I've ever testified together. So
that's why I brought you up here.
It's a first this morning. OBAs, as I understand it, before I started last summer, took a look at all the tax credits before the legislature this session, and this was among the favorites that were discussed. I planned on keeping my comments very brief because I knew we were going to have a long day the other day. So essentially, we're just here to lend our support to the great testimony that you heard last week. And that's about it.
Okay, and I wanted to thank you and the OBA for doing such a thorough and comprehensive job of really analyzing some of these. It really helps us to have organizations like yours that actually prioritize the credits, so appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make sure that the people who did the work know that.
Okay.
Before my time.
All right. Who's next?
Great. Thanks so much. For the record, my name is Elana Guiney with the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I appreciate the opportunity to sit here in between these two. You know, the AFL-CIO has long called for a review of all of our tax credits, and I'm so glad to be able to testify in front of this committee when we're finally doing that. We have asked many of the same questions about tax credits in the past that you all are asking this year on the forms that you're having proponents fill out, and we're so glad to see that. In our review of tax credits in the past, when we've asked questions about tax credits, this one has always come up near the top of really fulfilling the requirements that we would like to see tax credits that are supposed to stimulate the economy fulfill. It creates good jobs, high-wage jobs, as you heard from many people last time we were here. It returns money to our economy, not only through those jobs, but through other spending. And it really does bring in a high level of return on investment compared to many of our other tax credits. It is incredible for us to hear people talking about the possible ability in the future to wean ourselves off this tax credit, to think about it as a way to build an industry and not something that we'll need, at least at this level, forever. It does what we think tax credits should do, and I am glad to be able to be here to lend our support as well.
Thank you. Mr. Perry.
For the record, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association, and I love to be sitting here with two beautiful leading ladies and me just to be a supporting actor. Billy's Angels, we'll call this, maybe.
Madam Chair, if I may take back the fact that I claim him as my husband, I would appreciate it.
I just wanted to add a couple of follow-up comments to some of the stuff you heard last Thursday, too. First of all, there's a tourism benefit, both short-term and long-term. We heard that there were over 500 people that came here for the leverage kind of fan club. Some of those came from as long or far away as England. Also last year, you had a 25th anniversary of Goonies up in Astoria, which brought over 3,000 people. You had a 25th anniversary in Brownsville for Stand By Me. So these have short-term and long-term tourism benefits. That's one of the reasons why our members like it so much. But I want to expand on something that a couple of the guys said that really help our industry. One of the guys talked about how there were 700 room nights that he brought when he came here. But the thing from a business perspective to remember why that's so beneficial or helpful is that's not one block of 700 rooms in one, because there's only a few hotels that could take that. But what that is that's a long sustained from 3 to 4 months, they sell about 20 to 30 rooms. So it enables small places to find an ability to grow. So when you look at small restaurants that want to get into the catering business, a three-month contract allows you to buy product or like plates, equipment, because you got a three-month contract and you can establish it over time. Even a friend of mine in Central Oregon, remember if they did The Postman with Kevin Costner a few years back, he was just starting in a tent and awning business, but it was a four-month contract, so he was able to buy new tents, do some different things to basically grow his business for the long term. So the fact that these are 3 to 4 month contracts really is beneficial to small businesses, whether it be lodging, catering, or supplemental things like tents. So this credit over the last couple of years has just been really helpful for the businesses in Oregon to grow as they've connected with these companies. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you, and thank you for your patience in waiting for the second day so that we could take our out-of-the-building witnesses last mm-hmm. week. Okay, Mike Dewey and Dan Eisenbeiss.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, Chair Berger, Mike Dewey for the record, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. I'll be brief. You've heard, I think, excellent testimony about this particular tax incentive. The Oregon Cable Association is aware of the state tax problems that we have, the state of the economy, and we understand that you need to scrutinize each and every tax credit very carefully. I listened to the testimony last Friday, and I thought the proponents, the people that really know how it works, did a very good job. We think this helps the economy. We believe it helps tourism, even your district, Representative Bentz.
Thanks.
And I saw a very good review of the film, by the way. Last but not least, but I think very important, Comcast is the largest cable provider in the state of Oregon, and some of you know in December of 2010, Comcast was provided the regulatory authority to purchase NBC Universal. And so we think there is a significant synergy between NBC and Comcast and other cable companies in terms of these incentives and trying to bring film and TV productions to Oregon. So we think there's another reason that this is a good investment, because we think it's going to help the state of Oregon. We think it helps Comcast, and we think it helps NBC. And that's good because Comcast is paying tax dollars in the state of Oregon. So I'll finish right there. Thank you.
Thank you. Dan.
Chair Burdick, Chair Bailey, Chair Berger, and members of the committee, for the record, Dan Eisenbeiss with the City of Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2167. You have before you a letter in support of the bill from the Portland City Council. We believe that the state's film and video incentives dovetail with our local efforts. I want you to be aware that we have a dedicated staff person at the Portland Development Commission who works with film and video productions to make sure that they have a streamlined permitting process and the resources they need at the local level. We also partner with the state film and video office on recruitment efforts. As you heard last week, the jobs that stem from these programs are quite diverse and high-quality jobs that benefit the entire state, not just Portland, but in Portland, in the Portland metropolitan region. In 2009, there was $52 million in direct spending that resulted from OPIF recruitment, with a total economic impact of $102 million. Looking more broadly, as Mr. Dewey just mentioned, there's often synergistic effects with other elements of the economy. The broader creative sector in the Portland region certainly benefits from this program in terms of the growth of the talent base and entrepreneurs in the region working in fields such as advertising. We also very much value the benefit of these productions in terms of putting Portland and Oregon on the map both for tourism purposes, but also in terms of attracting potential investment. So we'd encourage you to consider the benefits of these programs that are perhaps not as easily quantified as the direct job creation, while also considering the direct economic benefits as well. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2167.
Thank you very much. Our questions from the panel. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else in the audience who'd like to speak on this? If not, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2167 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2404.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2404 creates a $2,500 tax credit for individuals who provide services as a mental health care provider to at least 10 veterans. For purposes of the tax credit, the bill would require the veterans be new patients of the provider and that they provide proof of their veteran status. It would apply the tax use beginning on or after January 1, 2011.
And this is a new tax credit, correct?
Correct.
Okay. We have one person, two people signed up. Val Conley and Bob Brigadier General Caldwell. Sorry, I messed up your title. It was easier when you were a colonel.
My life was easier, too.
Yes, I'm sure.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Val Conley. I am the acting deputy director for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I was also a member of the legislative task force on women veterans health care. I am here today to support House Bill 2404A. House Bill 2404A comes to you from the Task Force on Women Veterans Health Care, but is a concept that would benefit all veterans in Oregon. As we continue the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, one of the so-called signature injuries of these conflicts has been post-traumatic stress disorder. According to studies, about 20% of the force is reporting PTSD symptoms when assessed. However, this number may be a bit deceiving in that the assessments require the soldier, sailor, airman, or Marine to self-identify their symptoms, and we all know that many are not doing so. The bottom line in Oregon is demand for mental health is outpacing supply. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs has vet centers providing PTSD counseling in Portland, Salem, Eugene, Grants Pass, and Bend. USDVA also provides mental health counseling at their hospitals and community-based outpatient clinics. However, the task force learned during tours to the VA medical facilities that VA providers can have patient loads of more than 100 veterans seeking help. Veterans complain that they cannot see their VA mental health care provider as often as they need to due to demand. Further, VA's system, while ever expanding, does not cover the entire state. Veterans in rural and remote Oregon face additional barriers to seeking mental health, including transportation, weather, and distance. House Bill 2404A is an attempt to address in some small way the veteran demand for mental health treatment. By providing a tax incentive for mental health care providers, the task force hopes that local providers would be interested in seeing veteran clients in their communities, helping to meet the ever-increasing demand for mental health care. The task force looks at House Bill 2404A as an investment. By providing a tax credit now, the state will be saving money in the long run in social service and criminal justice costs of not treating veterans suffering from various mental health and emotional issues. Today, we talk about the cost of veterans suffering from various mental and emotional issues. Today, we talk about the cost of Vietnam veterans in terms of homelessness, law enforcement, social services, and more. The reason is we did not assess and treat these veterans when they came home. Instead, we ignored them, resulting in significant costs down the road. The old saying, you can pay me now or you can pay me later, is true in this case. House Bill 2404A will not solve the problem of demand for veterans needing mental health care. However, it will be a part of the solution, especially in areas where VA cannot provide the service. Thank you for considering this bill, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. We'll hear from Brigadier General Caldwell first, and then we'll go to questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department, and we wholeheartedly support this this action. I think, as was well stated by ODVA, unfortunately, we find out about many mental health issues of veterans and even current Oregon National Guard soldiers through the law enforcement system, and then we've missed the boat. We've increased the costs, and they usually refer back to the PTSD or some other issue. Just to give you context, the Oregon National Guard in the last 8.5 years since the wars began, we've created over 14,000 individual veterans in the state of Oregon just from the Oregon Guard of soldiers and airmen. Presently, we have 1,100 soldiers and airmen deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan. We are scheduled to have another 700 deploy next year. So even though we see the trend kind of dropping off right now with the involvement in Iraq declining considerably, we still see this need. We think that, as so well stated, it's particularly desperately needed in the rural areas. For example, the unit we have in Iraq right now is my former battalion. It starts out in Hood River and goes to Ontario, right down Interstate 84. So we've got an entire rural area of northeast Oregon and eastern Oregon. We have one vet center in La Grande, and then the other services in Walla Walla. So you can see the services are far and few between. So I think anything we can do to encourage private entrepreneurs to assist in this manner is going to be to our benefit downstream. So I would endorse the bill and request that you move it speedily through the process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions, Representative Brewer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to understand the existence of the issue here. Explain to me, particularly in rural counties, but also in metropolitan areas, why would a mental health provider currently not provide these services to a returning vet?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Ira Brewer, there are many mental health care providers who are not educated in the issues of post-traumatic stress disorder. Another big issue is military sexual trauma, and they just do not have the background to take care of these particular veterans, particularly combat veterans.
If I might follow up then. So how I want to connect the dots here. So how does providing this credit then make these mental health providers competent then to provide that service?
Well, hopefully with this credit, it will incentivize mental health care providers to get the training necessary to treat these veterans. That's our hope.
That's the hope. Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Actually, she raises a very good question. What protections do we have that someone might just get into it when they're not qualified to provide the services, that actually where it might, the incentive might kind of backfire, where people who are not qualified might get into the business and maybe end up doing more harm than good?
Madam Co-Chair, hopefully there's required training that you have to have, required by people that oversee the mental health care field. I'm not really sure how that is set up. I know most of them do specialize in particular issues. Some are specialize in family. Some specialize in women's mental health care treatment. So I don't know that there is a guarantee, because I'm not real sure what the requirements are.
Madam Chair, just I'll weigh in here just a little bit. The I think since the early part of the decade, there was clearly a gap between the typical mental health care provider and what we determined in the military, that some of the causes and effects of the post-traumatic stress. It's clear to me from our conversations with many of the local providers that they have taken this on in a big way to study it, to understand it, because they're seeing it whether or not we like it or not. They show up in their jails. They show up in their other systems, family breakdowns, et cetera, et cetera. So I think at the local level, you're seeing a good deal of study going on and a good deal of understanding. The Veterans Administration has done some significant outreach to the local communities because they know that they're going to be seeing these individuals and their families. So I think we have a far better understanding today, a decade later, than we did 10 years ago. Having said that, that doesn't necessarily mean that they have a certificate that says I've been through the VA training. However, they can get that type of training. I think at the bottom line is that there is a difference, all right, and there are a lot of veterans won't talk to anybody that doesn't get that. But if they're already in the system, and that's typically what's happening, is they get in the system, then they're going to deal with them one way or the other. And I would say that from our conversations, particularly in the rural areas, we know that those mental health care providers at the local level are reaching out to find out more about this phenomenon and try to deal with it, even though they may not be a veteran themselves. Most of the caregivers at the VA aren't necessarily veterans, but they understand the psychic of the whole problem. So I think it's a better field, a better studied field now than it has been. It doesn't make it a perfect system, but it does make it that they're dealing with them one way, easy way, or hard way.
Okay. Representative Wand.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I believe Representative Benz was next.
Were you first in the queue?
No, but thank you, Representative. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I had actually a couple of technical questions, and I'm not sure to whom I should address them, but so I'll just address them to this panel. The first is in paragraph 2, where it talks about, quote, an individual who provides the services. My experience back in Eastern Oregon suggests that many of the folks that are listed as providers actually work for LLC or some other business, and so I'm not quite sure who would be entitled, if anyone, to the benefit when it's directed toward an individual. The second is in 2A or 3A, where it says is a new patient of the mental health care provider, and that seemed to be dramatically limiting when 10 are required. So without a definition of new, I wasn't sure exactly if anybody would ever qualify under this bill. So those two things need to be addressed if the device is going to work.
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, this language, I underlined it as well because it we'll see it in another bill about TRICARE. Essentially, we have, in Baker is a good example, in Baker City there's a LLC that does provide a good deal of different services, health and mental health. Yet they've been doing this since the beginning of our deployments in Eastern Oregon, which has became their clients, if you will, the TRICARE, the families and the individuals, and now the mental health. Unfortunately, the way this is written, everybody that's currently being served under that LLC, they don't qualify. They don't qualify for the TRICARE tax write-off either. I totally agree with you. If I could change it, I would change it today, because I think that's a bad sentence in there, because essentially we're going to incentivize the people that aren't on the game now, and those that have been doing this work for the last decade, they just got to eat it. And I think that's patently unfair on both bills.
Okay. Representative Wand.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Do we know how many mental health professionals there are in the state that could potentially qualify for this?
I don't have that information.
I don't know.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions?
We can find out, though.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 2404? If not, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2404 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3248. Chris.
Madam Chair, House Bill 3248 is also a new credit. It creates a credit for members of the Oregon National Guard or military reservists on active duty deployed outside of the United States. And the credit is for access to the Internet. The amount of the credit is equal to the amount actually paid by the taxpayer to the service provider for the Internet access or usage and applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2012.
Okay. Representative Parrish. And whoever you want to bring up, if anyone.
Thank you. The record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, Westland, Tualatin. Collins, I'm bringing you this bill this morning, having just come off of a deployment myself. And one would think that when you send your loved one overseas, that communication, especially when you've got young family, being gone for a year, It would be a vital part of keeping a relationship together. It would be a vital part of staying connected to your children as they grow up and leave, and your soldier's gone. We heard testimony in the Veterans Affairs about this bill, where essentially the way the process works is when you deploy, you're essentially asked not to take your cell phone over. You're not checking in from Facebook in the desert. If you want the internet, it would be the equivalent of us sitting on the House floor with our laptops open, having a conversation with your spouse or your children for 15 minutes, and God and everybody gets to hear what you're saying. So if you want to have a fight with your wife about your finances, or if you want to wish your child Merry Christmas, you're doing it in front of everybody. Now, that's the free internet that we give, communications that we give to soldiers for a year. You want to have a private internet communication? You pay for it, to the tune of somewhere between $65 and $100 a month. Now, as an officer's wife, wasn't a hardship. I was mad about it. Wasn't a hardship. But when you're talking about an enlisted soldier's family, who's somebody who's making potentially only $2,400 a month, and the soldier's family is paying for the house and home and utilities here, to then go and have to pay for it over there, suddenly the communication cost for a soldier who's making $2,400 a month is now 5% of their gross base pay. The divorce rate from our deployments is extremely high. Connections to our children are extremely rough. We continue to send soldiers overseas cycle after cycle. There's no end in hope that right now that we are going to pull out of Iraq or Afghanistan anytime soon. And yet we continue to send our soldiers overseas from Oregon. And understand, when we deploy a citizen soldier, this would be someone who potentially is leaving a higher paying job here at home to go take a lesser paying job in the field. So when you think about what it would be if the state of Oregon, we're all serving the state of Oregon. They're serving the state of Oregon. These are Oregon National Guard soldiers. If we checked your telephone at the door every time we came to this building, particularly for those of us who live in far corners or might live in far corners and you're living here and your family might be back in eastern Oregon, we take away your phone, we let you have your internet on the house floor and all the communications with your family on our house floor, and then if you want internet service up in your offices, we're going to charge you $100 out of your paycheck. That would be the equivalent to deploying somebody overseas and asking them to do the exact same thing. So this bill, since we can't, our Oregon National Guard soldiers might be Oregon National Guard, but they're paid by the federal government. We can't give them a pay raise. They don't have an association or a union who negotiates them benefits. This is what they get. The federal government says you're going to pay for this, and families do it because otherwise they have no connection to their spouse, to their loved one, to their children. So it's an important bill, should pass, and you'll be helping military families across our state. Understand, fiscal, probably a little bit unknown, because sometimes we only have a few hundred soldiers over there, or like what we had last year where we had over 3,000 soldiers over there. But when you're talking about, again, this is the only mechanism for people to communicate, and they do it, and it's a hardship, and do I pay the light bill here at home, or do I keep my internet turned on overseas? You'll find that most women, since these are particularly affecting women and children here back stateside, they're going to forego the electricity payment so they can keep that internet turned on overseas. So,
thank you.
That's my song and dance. Any questions?
Questions for the panel?
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Parrish, you said that you and your husband chose to pay for the personal internet. Mm-hmm. How often do you think you communicated via that
line? Well, when it works, because understand, there's a lot of times it doesn't work. You're still paying for it. The government, federal government and their contractors doesn't give you a refund for it when it's broken. But for a lot of soldiers, and particularly ones who, not like Mark, who had to travel around a lot, if they're situated where they're staying, they can get on daily. So picture trying to do Christmas morning and Skype in and open up presents with your children from a computer terminal. I mean, that's what these families are doing. Skype is wonderful. I mean, I'm sure, probably some of you have used Skype, but Skype has pay-for-services that are above and beyond. So what we were able to do was that Mark's grandmother, who's 80-some years old, lives in Rhode Island, she could actually then dial a 503 area code, which if he was online, she could dial him from a landline. She didn't have to have a computer. So now when you're talking about grandparents and people who don't have the technology and they're not going to get on Skype, but she knows she can dial 503 because Skype has set up a phone number for him in Iraq, That's a huge deal. So not only that, from his, you know, computer, he's able to dial my cell phone. I could be in the car with the children, driving them to and from home, and he can connect that way. You know, you're also dealing with a 13-hour difference in time change. So trying to coordinate schedules above and beyond is a little bit challenging for everybody, keeping your kids up late so you can make the call with, you know, dad, or getting up early before school. But the ability to do that and stay connected, when you're talking about, you know, we had the Afghanistan deployment, and the divorce rate from that, somewhere between 60 and 80%. These families are fighting about finances because they're already strapped. They're fighting about, you know, decisions for the kids. They're trying to maintain the, you know, emotional connection of actually being married and staying in a relationship. But these deployments are extremely hard. And if we don't give people good communication tools, they come home and get divorced. So,
thank you.
Thanks.
Other questions? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This isn't so much a question as a comment that the review of these veterans' bills made me think of. And it really is, it moves slightly away from the policy issues that we're debating up to a question of where this particular expenditure might fit. Because I could have raised this issue with the film tax credit also, where we might say, gee, I wonder what budget this would fit under. Should that have gone under the governor's budget? Should this go under the military's budget? As just because you want to get a feel for how much all of these costs are, where they fit in some sort of a overall approach. And I know this committee is going to have to start weighing and balancing these credits. And I wonder if it is. I don't want to say anything negative about this particular credit because I kind of like the policy end of it, but it needs to be viewed in the context of the larger picture of the military budget, I think. And that's one way of measuring all of the different weighing and balancing we're going to have to do. So I just wonder, do these tax credits find their way at some point over, under, around the bigger budget for the group of folks we're talking about trying to benefit?
That's an excellent question. As I listen to the testimony, sometimes I think, let's give these people a raise.
Well, and unfortunately, again, since they, even though they're our Oregon soldiers, they're tied to the federal pay standard, which is step and grade. So, you know, every 2 years you get a raise. If you're just, you know, that's, you have to kind of wait, or every promotion. So, you know, in the case, marginal cost of living raises. We're talking, I think this year we're looking at, you know, a 1.6% or less is the pay raise. So these are folks who arguably, when you're talking about a soldier who is only, you know, an E2 or E3 and they're making $1,500, $1,600 a month, and they're going over the desert with a 60-pound rucksack on their back in the heat, they're not making a lot of money. So, you know, I know you heard the other bill about tax credits, and, you know, we're not a base community. And that is a really huge, important factor in how we look at military. We don't live at Fort Lewis. I've lived at Fort Benning. You know, when you're on a base community, it's a whole other world. There are support services that come in from the federal government. We don't have those. I went to dinner a few weeks ago with Darlene Hooley. She had an event, and sitting with a woman from the Portland Trail Blazers, and the Blazers do this, like, a couple times a year. They do a military family night, and I turned to the woman. I said, you know what? It's not about that you're giving the discounted ticket to soldiers, which is great. We appreciate that. What you're doing is you're giving them a base. You're pulling in people from McMinnville and from Salem and from Eastern Oregon who come over from this game, and they never see each other otherwise, and you're giving them a base. You're giving them a place where they can actually come together and connect. And in Oregon, with no base, we don't have that kind of connection. So not only then, if you're thinking about in the context of this particular bill or some of like the other tax credit bills where you've got providers who really don't understand the military, and they're not enough of them because I took my child and he got services, and to find people who are equipped to deal with these families, and again, not having this base community, there's a very big disconnect living in Westland, Oregon, and your husband's in the desert, and everybody else's husband's driving downtown. People don't understand that. So not only just the ability to connect to, you know, medical providers who understand, to connect to neighbors who might understand, when our community steps out and say, we're going to give you Rose Garden Arena and come bring your family, that's their base. So being able to connect to your spouse while they're deployed, being able to connect to other people who understand what you're going through is really important. But my neighbors, when I'm gone, their husband's not deployed. They go to work. Mine's gone. So these types of bills matter. I don't know whether you put them under the military budget. I don't think we do it at the detriment of cutting the rest of the budget for the military. We've continued to do that, and yet the military is a it has a positive revenue impact when you're talking about money out of the general fund and then comes back in dollars in above and beyond what we're taking out. I don't know if we actually want to cut that down further, but somewhere we need to value this, and I'm hoping it starts here this session. So,
thank you, Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I Representative Parrish, you present something very compelling here, and I have a big heart for this. Understanding, sorry.
She starts crying, I start crying.
Sorry. Having a daughter that's a captain, yeah, it's kind of important. But recognizing the financial hole that we're in as a state, what are your thoughts on providing a partial credit or a credit to enlisted versus officers? And maybe somehow limiting breaking us in, something like that. What are your thoughts?
You know what? I'll take what we can get. I still think we value the whole thing, because when we walk into this building, we're serving the state, and we make, what, $1,800 a month and some gas money. Our basic needs, though, are still met when we come in here. We have food. We've got access to the phone. We have access to everything else, and we're asking these families to take a hardship. You know, some of these wives actually have to quit their job. So but even if you're, I mean, I stopped working when Mark was deployed. I own my own company, but I was also working at an ad agency at the time, and I stopped working at the ad agency. There's no way I can do three kids and do a deployment. That's just not going to happen. I need to have the flexibility. So, yes, even as an officer's wife, you know, we, like I said, we're in a position we could afford it. But I know other folks whose wives quit their jobs, and now you've gone suddenly down to one income. And it's still a hardship, even if you're, you know, a captain or a lieutenant or whatever. It's still a hardship. I'd like the full thing. I think it's worth the full thing. I think it, you know, sends a message. That's kind of common language around here. Sends a good, strong signal that, you know, okay. We can't give you a raise, but at least we can help support your costs when you're over there.
We've got some other witnesses that we need to get to.
Great.
So thank you very much. Okay, Brigadier General Caldwell is back on with T.A. Barnhart.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. We support House Bill 3228. Some of the questions that were brought up earlier in the previous discussion, I commend Representative Parrish for being so enthusiastic about this particular piece of legislation. It's important. It's important that we keep our families as best we can to keep them together. Her comments about the high divorce rates are accurate. My own brother is in the Ontario unit, and he's in Iraq right now. has four little kids, a baby about a year old, and he was standing in line about 2 weeks ago trying to get on the internet. And they got a rocket attack, and so he said he never got to talk to his kids that day, because he was, and he said, he was reluctant to pay the money. He's a sergeant. He was reluctant to pay the money, but he said, I'm going to pay the money. So send me the email, and I said, I'll send you the check. So I'm paying for his internet so he can talk to his kids. Our emergency relief fund, this legislature provided $500,000 for emergency relief in the last biennium. The majority of that money has gone to pay for things like excessive cell phone bills, believe it or not, to the point of thousands of dollars of young families who are not accustomed to being deployed and separated, and they run up excessive cell phone bills because the Iraqis have figured it out. There is a market out there for cell phones. So they sell them, and they sell them to these soldiers, and they buy them there through these marketing schemes that they have on these bases, and then these young soldiers use them constantly, and they run up excessive bills. And I would, since I'm one of the three signatories on the Emergency Relief Fund, I can tell you that probably over half of those are cell phone or internet bills that we're paying when they get themselves buried into financial difficulty. So I would concur that this is a pretty small amount of effort for the state of Oregon. Representative Bentz brought up our budget, and I agree with that. Budgets are the central theme here this session. I just showed one of your learned staff. Our budget right now is exactly $100,000 less in real money to run our facilities and run our business than it was in 1991. So we have $100,000 less in the military department budget. Real money, no inflation, no gimmicks, just flat dollars. So if you want to put it in our budget, I would say that I think my boss would say, yes, I'll do that. If that's what it takes, we'll pay it. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you very much. Bernhardt.
Good morning. My name is T.A. Barnhart. I live in Portland in Representative Bailey's district. Used to live in Representative Gelser's district back in Corvallis. My older son, my younger son, Jesse's in the Coast Guard up in Washington. My older son, Alex, lives in Silverton now with his wife, Molly, and his daughter, Savannah. He joined the Oregon National Guard back in 2007, knowing that he would be sent to Iraq, and I wasn't very pleased with his decision, but in May of 2009, the 42nd, they, as you know, mobilized the big group of them, and that was on a Monday. He and Molly, who were not married at the time, went back to their home in Redmond. Wednesday, she found out she was pregnant. Thursday, they got married, and then Saturday, he left for his training in Georgia. And before he went to Iraq, they were able to spend a long weekend together in Savannah, Georgia, and that's where they got my granddaughter's name, Savannah Grace. And he was able to come back. This is Christmas Eve 2009, just a few days before he'd been in Iraq, and a week later he'd be back. Alex missed all of Molly's pregnancy. He missed the first half of Savannah's life. And for the privilege of being possibly able to talk to his wife every day, he paid over $70 a month for really crappy internet service. This isn't speculative. This is what kids like him had to go through to try and stay in touch with their family. They don't complain about it, so you may not have heard about it. I learned about this. It's real weird. I learned about it from Senator Merkley, who couldn't believe it himself when he had found out about it. And he was unable to do anything about it. It's really unfair that we send our kids over there to possibly die and then let them get ripped off like this. It's unconscionable. I know the budget's horrible. I know that the cuts that are going to be made will cost people lives. I don't know if this is doable. I hope it is. It's a gesture. It says something to these people who signed up to serve their country, and they couldn't even be given the decency of being allowed to talk to their family while they served. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Morris.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both for your testimony, and thank you, Representative, for your testimony. General, if you were to design a program that would provide this benefit, but do it in a way that you had shared services based on the squad or the and you had maybe a voucher system where we could actually achieve this, but do it with less cost. I guess my question would be, how would you design it so it would work as intended, but at the least cost?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, you know, the technology is so wonderful these days. I mean, we literally had a conversation with our units deployed, their leadership, 2 weeks ago while we had our National Guard Association's conference here in Salem, and it was live, and it was extremely good. And we had Afghanistan, Iraq, we had them all. If I was king, I would demand that the federal government set up that same system for these soldiers. Unfortunately, the as was indicated in testimony, some of the internet service is pretty crappy. It depends on satellites, and most of those satellites are got high demand, high use, high need. So it's difficult to get on those satellites and get the time. So you got to play with whatever commercial service is out there. I think a voucher system would be a very good deal. I think it would be If we could design that. I know for our people, the problem is that we got a lot of reservists and other individual active duty soldiers that we have no way to connect with in an effective fashion. So I think it falls back to the individual if they choose to want to do that with their laptop sitting in their hooch in Baghdad or some other place, then it's really up to them and what kind of commercial services are out there, because the military doesn't allow you to do that, only on that one certain system that they have, and you got to stand in line. As Representative Parrish indicated, you get 15 minutes, sometimes you get 10, depending on the circumstances, sometimes you get 5, and you stand in line. There was an old saying about a first sergeant told a soldier once, he said, "I'll bet you when I die you'd stand in line to pee on my grave." Or you'd pee on my grave, the first sergeant said. And the soldier says, "First sergeant, I get out of this army, I'm never standing in line again." Mm-hmm. And I think in the army you stand in line. That's what you do. You stand in line to eat. You stand in line to do anything. So that's a common trait, and it's a dangerous trait, because even with there's a whole lot less activity than there was 5 years ago, but they're still sending rockets in every single day and mortars and artillery rounds to these young people, and it's just horrific. So if I had the system, I'd say everybody gets a laptop, everybody connects, you got these hours of windows, and that satellite's yours. That would be my system if I was king, but I'm not.
We wish you were. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And I want to make the record really clear, because I happen to know the General's brother extremely well, and I'm happy he wasn't hurt. The policy issue is easy. The question that the Senator asks is a really good one, and that is the tax credit the proper device to effectuate the policy? And that's why I suggest that the matter needs to be viewed in the context of the grant approach, similar to the one we're using with the film credit, because in that fashion we might be more likely to help more folks accomplish the policy purpose, but at the same time keeping in mind whatever the cost of the program might be. It's unfortunate that these kind of incredibly important matters get mixed, but they do. But I want the General to be clear on it, because I feel this is, as much as one that's not a brother, can concern over the folks over there. So we'll make sure you understand that, General.
Yes, sir. I think we did similar to that when we had money in our budget for hunting and fishing licenses. The law is still in effect. We just don't have the money to pay for them. The legislature said if you, instead of making it, show up with your ID card and get a hunting and fishing license, that we'll reimburse those that purchase them. And we did that, and it worked for our soldiers, and we had other soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen. We had them all come into our department with their voucher. Basically, it was a copy of their hunting license and what they paid for it. They'd send it to us. We'd pop them a check out the next day. It worked pretty well. I don't remember the exact dollars, but it was in the $60,000, $70,000 mark, if I remember correctly, that we had a fund to do that with. And it worked well when we had the money.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wanted to testify? Okay, we will close the hearing on House Bill 3248. And we will open a hearing on House Bill 3206.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill modifies an existing credit. It increases the tax credit for TRICARE providers from $1,000 to $5,000 and applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2011.
Great. Representative Escobar will be coming to testify on this, but we will start out with panel H.A. McDonald, Bob Dumig, and again, our star witness, Brigadier General Caldwell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. As I said in earlier testimony, this has, I think, been a very good attempt to try to encourage TRICARE providers to serve TRICARE patients. What you probably don't know is that when any soldier in the Oregon National Guard or airman can currently get on TRICARE for a fee, even if they're not deployed, they're not in what's known as Title 10 status, which is federal active duty. The problem with that has been that even though it's very minimal care, is that the reimbursement rates on TRICARE are tied to Medicare and Medicaid. Most providers have a limit on what they can afford to take for TRICARE and or Medicare and Medicaid. So there's been real no advantage, even though they may have better than nothing, as some say, but it's still not a very robust health care service. That problem is exacerbated when we deploy large numbers of people. As I indicated, the 3rd Battalion, 116th Cavalry, goes from Hood River to Ontario, rural Oregon. Very few providers in that area are signed up with TRICARE. We've worked diligently with the TRICARE provider. It's a subsidiary of Blue Cross Blue Shield named TriWest. They've gone out. They've encouraged physicians and other medical providers to get on board and sign up so we can get proper care for our families and for those soldiers, predominantly families when they're deployed, obviously. In some cases, the nearest provider may be, you know, several hundred miles away, and that creates a problem. What this tax credit was designed to do was to try to encourage physicians and other medical providers to sign up on TRICARE, become a member of that service, which then allows them some other benefits, but it's been exceedingly slow to grasp, get a foothold. The physicians just simply haven't been comfortable with it. Now, part of that, and I remember, Senator, I'm looking at Senator Telfer because we were in Bend and had a major expose over there at the hospital. You were there, and I think some of it was education on the fact of getting the providers to understand what TRICARE is and isn't. Unfortunately, it had a bad history. It used to be when we had all of our full-time active guard reservists on TRICARE duty, they would the federal government ran out of money in May. They just didn't pay bills till October. So providers were sitting there with a bill for service that they were duly owed, and they just didn't get paid. And most of the providers said, I'm not going to deal with this anymore. And most of the folks in Bend thought exactly that's what the program was. The good news is, under the current system, is that they can actually have payback into their accounts in 7 days or less if they sign up. If they don't sign up, it takes longer. We have tried meetings after meetings after meetings. We made a foothold in Bend, did quite well, solidified our provider care network over there, which was very, very beneficial to the unit that was deployed. They're now home, and now we got the problem over in Northeast Oregon, and we're still struggling to do that. I think this bill is a good attempt to try to further this program along, get more providers involved, and provide that service that our families desperately need. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We'll take the rest of the testimony and then go to questions. Who wants to go next?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt McDonald, United Veterans of Oregon. We put this bill in basically because the $1,000 that they used to get was not working. It also, TRICARE also covers retirees. And hopefully, with this increase in this amount, that the doctors will begin and healthcare providers will begin to accept TRICARE, and our retirees and our active duty personnel that come under TRICARE will be better served.
Thank
you. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
We'll take Mr. Dumig, and then we'll open it to questions.
Madam Chair, multiple chairs, members of the committee. My name is Bob Dumig. I'm with the Oregon Office of Rural Health, and we administer the TRICARE tax credit. We are here neither in support or opposition to the bill, just with the 3 points we would like to raise that are kind of important. As the bill's written, as 3206 is written, it retains the $2,500 signing bonus as it was in the original bill. However, the original legislation had a $1,000 tax credit. This one has a $5,000. As written, we believe that if you keep the signing bonus, most people aren't going to take that anyway. The law is written that you can take either one. You can't take both. So the reality is if you have the chance between a $2,500 signing bonus and a $5,000 tax credit, you'll take the $5,000. So that's actually a component for administrative purposes that would be better if it was removed from the legislation. It would simplify. Second is, under Senate Bill 1060, passed in 2008 in special session, The legislation stated that the Office of Rural Health would certify 500 providers in 08, 1,000 in 09, 1,500 in 2010, and 2,000 in 2011. As this bill is written, as 3206 is written, there are no more limitations on that. So we just point that out to remind you that in the past we've operated with a certain number of tax credits that we were allowed to certify. This would open it up to the language which says any less than one in a rural area and more than 10 in an urban area. Right now, in order to make that 1,500 and those 2,000 tax credits work, we put in some criteria so that if you're a frontier provider in a frontier community, you had to see at least one TRICARE patient. If you were in a rural community but not frontier, you had to see more than one. And if you were in an urban community, you had to see more than 43. That was the only way to balance this and make sure that we could meet those numbers that were set out in the original legislation. If it passes without restrictions on that again, we would probably see a large increase in an increase in urban providers, not necessarily in rural providers signing up for the TRICARE. The third piece on it is the effective date of the bill. It says effective for the tax year 2011. Currently, the legislation has this tax credit in place for 2011 with a maximum of 2,000 certificates available. So if it passes as is, as we read it, that would alter the last year of the legislation, and we would no longer be restricted to the 2,000 certificates available. So if you wanted to keep this existing year operating as we've started it, then changing the effective date of this legislation to 2012 would probably do that.
This is for Mr. Dumig. Actually, for any of you, if we're in a very difficult budget situation, this would expand the revenue impact of the credit. If we were to target this somehow, I mean, if we don't have enough money to do everything, where would the targeting best take place? In the frontier communities, the rural communities? What would you...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, being born and raised in a frontier community, I've never heard it's called that, but I guess that's okay. I would suggest that indeed that we look at the less populated counties in Oregon, and I would particularly look at those areas where we have units assigned, which is not the case in every single rural community, but certainly those are going to be the higher impacts. As I indicated, we literally have everything from Hood River County to Malheur County with units deployed right now, and I think that's where we have seen the bigger problem. We noticed that in Bend. We went over and, as I indicated, did some spade work, and we helped ourselves out there. There's more opportunities here in the Willamette Valley, Portland, Eugene, Salem, for medical services, and then we've had a good response from the communities, the medical communities, to provide that. The other thing that I always, when the bill was first introduced and enacted, and we were very pleased about it, what I didn't recognize when the thing came through the first time was that those providers that were already on board doing this work and typically not making any money, I mean, they're doing it more out of their patriotic viewpoints and I think just wanting to serve their fellow humans, human beings, they were actually punished because they were already on board. They didn't get that opportunity, and I thought that was patently unfair, as I indicated earlier. So I guess if I was going to change it, I would change both of those, and I would make it one. I would put it out in the rural communities and try to solidify that base of care first in a tight fiscal environment.
Thank you. You agree?
Madam Chair, yeah, that would be probably the toughest area to hit and the one that we'd want to focus on the most.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Representative Pence.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I actually called a doctor in Ontario this morning to find out how well this was working or if it would work better, and he indicated that he wanted to know how he could find a list of all of the different credits of this nature so he was sure he wasn't missing some of them. And he thought that remark was kind of interesting to me because I was thinking this is supposed to be an incentive. The fact that he was not aware of it was not, I wasn't happy about that. So I guess my question would be, how do we make sure all of our providers know about whatever it is we are putting out there to incent them?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, what we do through our office is it's continually put out with our website, with our regular mailings. I don't know the exact number, but it goes out to providers for every year when it's time to re-up for this tax credit. So we do move it out through our usual mode of communications with rural communities. We don't have any money to do any big mailings or any additional pieces to that, but we do it through our regular communications.
Madam Chair, I might just add on to that is that I know that TriWest uses this in their marketing scheme as well when they're out trying to find physicians, medical service providers who will do that. They use this as part of their marketing. But again, it's if they don't happen to get to the big meeting like we had in Bend, which was unusual, then they're probably going to have to hunt and peck and figure it out, and they're probably not doing that very much because they're busy serving patients.
Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had maybe a question more for the committee, not being a healthcare person, but learning on the fly that delivery of health services in rural Oregon has some unique challenges, and this seems to be one of them when you talk about the frontier. Do we comprehensively, as a legislature, look at delivery of healthcare in rural communities, and how do we tie the needs of the military in the rural communities into that, and is that a better place for this conversation? Not this credit goes beyond that, but it just seems to be part of a bigger conversation, perhaps.
So, Bob, you probably are more familiar with how the legislature. I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Brewer, at this point, I don't think there's been a conversation about how the military fits in the rural communities per se. Our office works with all the small communities, certified rural health clinics, critical access hospitals, et cetera, and working with their healthcare delivery systems. We help them recruit. We help them keep their clinics and hospitals viable. It is always a challenge for providers in rural communities. We're short on them, whether they be mid-levels or MDs and DOs. So we continue to recruit, and I think that's a challenge for military folks as well, particularly when you're looking for mental health, which is a huge challenge for all people in the rural communities. So we do work with and have begun to work even more closely with the Department of Veterans Affairs out of Vancouver, Washington, to see what we can do to increase our activities together when it comes to recruiting and contracting to help provide those services through their areas. But at this stage, I don't believe that the Oregon legislature has had that type of a conversation.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. Is Representative Esquivel? Okay. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Representative Esquivel couldn't come, so I thought I would just pop in since we heard this in our committee. A couple things that are a challenge.
Identify yourself.
Representative Julie Parrish, House District 37. Representative Brewer asked a question about rural health and as it relates to the military, and I wanted to address that because we have talked about that. Rural health in Oregon, I sit on the healthcare committee, is a huge issue. It's hard enough to get providers down there serving anybody, but when you're faced, if you're a provider, faced with the choice of do I pick Cadillac Insurance, an OEB or a Blue Cross, or do I pick a TRICARE, which has low reimbursement rates, a lot of providers tend to gravitate towards the higher paying insurance, right, wrong, or otherwise. When we moved back to Oregon from being stationed in Georgia in 1999, my doctor, rural provider, Southern Oregon, took TRICARE, and I can recall conversations with him about whether or not his practice would continue to take TRICARE because of the reimbursement rates. He's over on the other side of the hall in the Senate side. You can certainly go ask him about it because Senator Bates was my doctor, and that conversation came up in their practice, and I don't recall whether or not they disbanded with TRICARE, but when you get a notice that a doctor that you're working with is no longer taking TRICARE and you need to find a new doctor, it happens quite routinely. It happens in the metro area. It happens a lot in the rural area, huge issue in the rural area. So here you've got a doctor who's got your patient history in your file and suddenly get a notice from TriWest that says your doctor no longer takes TRICARE, you're going to have to find a new one. Hard enough to A, find a new one, but B, all your medical history goes with that and that you've got to go start and build a relationship all over again. So for military families, and particularly in the rural community, community. This is a definite challenge. You know, the other piece of this is you're looking at specialists. I mean, beyond just your basic PCP type practice, when you're talking about trying to find an ENT or some other type of specialist practitioner, now we're talking the pool of doctors gets less and less and less. And, you know, so I'll be in a situation where my pediatrician, you know, will refer me, and the three doctors she refers me won't take TRICARE. So it becomes a challenge to get good quality medical care. And now look at how limited our specialist pool is down in rural Oregon. It becomes even more of a challenge. So the committee was very supportive of this as a concept, and hopefully, again, would encourage your support as well. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And we are out of time. So is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this? Okay, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 3206, and that completes our business for the day, committee, and we will see you bright and early Thursday morning. We are adjourned.